Good morning, everyone. My name is Jonathan Freeman Cabbage. I've been at Cedar Ridge since 2003, if you include the 5 years where my husband Darren and I lived in Massachusetts. I assure you, our hearts were in Spencerville every Sunday. You might also know us as Langston's dads. He makes a point of regaling the church with a commentary on the contents of his toy box every week, so I've had to sequester myself here in the guest room so he doesn't find me. If this video cuts off abruptly, you'll know my cover's been blown. This week for God in the Movies, we're looking at a fairly recent film. The Farewell came out in 2019, so approximately two lifetimes ago, if you count in pandemic time like I do. It came out of the small studio A24 and is set mostly in China. Apart from its main character, Billy Wang, played by the sometimes controversial comedian and rapper Awkwafina, there's not a lot that mainstream American audiences would necessarily recognize or identify with just by watching a trailer. The story is, we are told, based on an actual lie. Billy Wang is a struggling writer living in New York City. Her parents moved here from China when Billy was 6 years old, and we get the sense that Billy still has a foot in both worlds. Billy visits her parents' suburban home regularly, dodging questions about money while taking advantage of their free laundry. Back in China, Billy's family consists of her Nai Nai, or grandmother, whom Billy speaks to every day, and Nai Nai's younger sister, known to Billy as Little Nai Nai, who watches out for Nai Nai and acts as her medical representative. The lie at the center of this film is a diagnosis. Nai Nai can't shake the cough she's had since her last cold. And when the hospital runs tests, they discover cancer in her lungs. In a cultural twist, Little Nai Nai is the first one to get this knowledge from the doctors. And along with the rest of the family, she decides to spare Nai Nai the anxiety of knowing that her death is imminent. Instead, the whole family makes a plan to reconvene in the city of Changchun under the pretense of the marriage of Billy's cousin, Hao Hao, which will give them all one final happy celebration with Nai Nai before she succumbs. Obviously, this plan raises all sorts of ethical questions. Does the family have a right to hide Nai Nai's diagnosis from her, or the truth about how much time she has left? Is it immoral to stage a sham wedding, which Nai Nai helps pay for, just to make Nai Nai's final memories happy ones? How far are family members willing to go to preserve the fiction? When does a merciful lie become a harm? When Billy finds out her grandmother's diagnosis, she faces all these questions plus one more complication. The family has decided that it's better if Billy doesn't return to China with them. In fact, they didn't even plan on telling her the truth of the situation. Her closeness with Nai Nai and her Americanized values around relationships and emotions makes them doubt she will be able to maintain the lie. In this first clip, we'll meet little Nai Nai and Nai Nai at the hospital, then see Billy at home with her father, Haiyan, and mother, Lujian. As you might expect, Billy doesn't listen to her parents, and she makes the journey alone back to China, surprising them all when she shows up on Nai Nai's doorstep. I love this sequence because it immediately complicates the moral picture I painted for you at the beginning. In my introduction, I talked about the lie, the omission, the ruse, the sham. I didn't talk about the pain Haiyan feels in facing the death of his mother, or the concern expressed by Lujian that the news of Nai Nai's diagnosis and the attending fear might be worse for her than the cancer. From where I sit in my Western values, it's easy for me to condemn the family's dishonesty, to treat Nai Nai's right to know, her right to self-determination as a sacrosanct principle. After all, didn't Jesus say that the truth would set us free? I'll confess that some of the Wang family values are hard for me to connect with. I've lost two of my four grandparents, one last December to COVID, though by the time it took him, his dementia was so advanced that his death felt like a merciful release. Of course, as I say that, I have to ask myself, a release for whom? Would he have preferred not to go on living as he was? Or do I just feel better now that I don't have to watch the person I once knew slip away? This question of what is best for the dying person and what is best for those around them is at the heart of this film. I also love that this is a film about a family. Though Billy is the protagonist, she's not the hero of the film, at least not in the Western sense. She doesn't set off on a crusade to enlighten her family about how they need to evolve. She does try. And what she says is not wrong, but it's also not the full picture. Just as we as individuals are not the full picture for ourselves or anyone else, and certainly not to God. It's good to remember that even as we practice our spirituality, which is not immune to self-centeredness. I remember our founding pastor, Brian McLaren, commenting one time on a contemporary Christian worship song that says that Jesus, like a rose trampled on the ground, took the fall and thought of me above all. Brothers and sisters, Brian said in that gentle way he has, I'm here to tell you that no one thinks of you above all except you. We are all parts of a whole, members of a body, as Paul tells us in his first letter to the Corinthian church. Starting in verse 12, just as a body, though one, has many parts, but all its many parts form one body, so it is with Christ. For we were baptized by one Spirit so as to form one body, whether Jews or Gentiles, slave or free, and we were all given one Spirit to drink. Even so, the body is not made up of one part, but of many. Now, if the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? But in fact, God has placed the parts in the body, every one of them, just as He wanted them to be. If they were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you, and the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable, and the parts we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty, while our presentable parts need no special treatment. But God has put the body together, giving greater honor to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. Now, let's be honest. Some of us hear this scripture, maybe we've heard it 100 times before. And we find it very easy to think of ourselves as parts of the body of Christ. Maybe the courageous heart, or the visionary eye, or the wise ear, or even the useful hand. We assign a hierarchy to the body parts, and we flatter ourselves in believing that we're probably somewhere in the top quartile. Modesty prevents us from claiming to be the head, since Paul already assigned that role to Christ earlier in the letter. But we probably don't place ourselves among the ranks of the spleen or the intestine or the toenail, even though we know those parts perform important functions. And please don't ask me what the intestines do in the body of Christ. Each of us navigates our relationship of the part to the whole differently in the context of our families, our work and social circles, and our church. There is no prescription to tell every person how to strike a balance between being true to oneself and following the guidance of others. This is especially true when it comes to issues of ethics and morality. Each of us lives with a moral code written on our hearts, as Paul says in his letter to the Romans. We are each accountable to our own conscience and to God. But moral and ethical codes are also part of the glue that holds communities together. Cedar Ridge is a community because of the shared values articulated in our vision statement. And those values have implications for what we deem healthy, unhealthy, or destructive. And it has never been the case that an individual's moral code coincides perfectly with their community's moral code. How do we navigate those discrepancies? I have to confess that this question has been one of the most formative of my life. I grew up in the conservative evangelical church, and when I came out as gay at the age of 23, I felt the inordinate pain of being pulled between the truth I knew in my heart about who I was as a beloved gay child of God and the moral codes of my family and my home church that told me what I was sinful, degenerate, unhealthy, and destructive. I had more than enough Christian friends who tried to convince me to subordinate my own sense of right and wrong, of truth, to what the church prescribed for me. And I had a number of gay and secular friends who believed I should just tell my church and my family, "Baby, I was born this way," and leave them in my dust. But neither of those options felt right to me. My love for my family wouldn't let me cut them off, and my love for God wouldn't let me continue to lie about who I was. The resolution of my dilemma wasn't anything anyone could have told me or my family to do. It had to be lived out, to be discovered, each of us for ourselves. But the journey towards resolution began and ended in a commitment to love one another and not to walk away. More often than not, it felt like a stalemate. But the incremental steps towards each other came as we refused to give each other ultimatums and instead gave each other the freedom to follow our own understanding of truth. When I told my parents that Darren and I were getting engaged, they didn't say we weren't welcome in their home. When they told me they wouldn't attend our wedding, I didn't say they needn't bother ever coming to visit again. Leaving the door open for each other like that made it possible years later for us to find some common ground where we could both be okay. We couldn't find it then, and sometimes it felt like we never would. But life changes people. Life changes all of us if we let it. And eventually love triumphed over the fear and division that plagued us for 3 years. For different reasons, this is also the dilemma Billy finds herself in as the fake wedding approaches. She sees her Nainai's happiness, but she struggles with knowing that it's built on false pretenses. For her, it's so clear that loving Nainai means telling Nainai the truth. In this next scene, Nainai has tried to sneak away to the hospital to find out why she's not feeling better, but the family finds out where she is and descends on her. Now Nainai herself is engaged in a deception, trying to assure everyone that she's absolutely fine and that they shouldn't worry. But in fact, she's the only one in the room who doesn't know that she's not fine, and that the medicine she seeks will have no effect on her condition. It's a crisis moment for them all. Is it time to come clean with Nainai about why she's still sick? Let's watch them sort it out. "You told them. I told you not to say anything," Nainai scolds little Nainai. "Why cause people distress if there's nothing to be done about it? What is a lie? Is there such a thing as a good lie, as the doctor puts it? What is the effect of a lie? What is the effect of the truth?" We also find out that Nainai herself has told such a lie years earlier when her husband was dying of cancer. Does that justify the family lying to her now? Jesus was no stranger to moral paradox. In fact, it was his embrace of paradox that humanity found so intolerable. The Gospels are replete with Jesus challenging the moral absolutes of his time. The religious elites came with their binary moral questions to entrap Jesus, and each time he exploded their binary. The only binary he clung to, if you can even call it that, was the two greatest commandments: love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. We tend to conflate this second commandment with something Jesus said earlier in his career, a principle we now call the Golden Rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But the two maxims are not quite the same. The Golden Rule is a prescription. It says that whatever I imagine I would like in a given situation, that's what's best for everyone else too. But the second commandment says that we should love others the way we love ourselves. That goes deeper than prescriptive actions. It means considering what's best for the other person from their perspective, not just from ours. This revision to the Golden Rule, do unto others as they would have you do unto them, is sometimes called the Platinum Rule, which sounds a little like an American Airlines reward status and is not nearly as poetic. But I think it challenges us to step out of ourselves and really begin to see things from another's point of view. Would it be easier for the family to tell Nainai and not have to keep pretending in front of her? Sure. But would that be best for her? In this next scene, Billy and her father and her uncle Haibin get to the crux of this cultural disconnection. Billy begins to see things from the family's perspective, and it changes the way she thinks about their love. But in the following scene, Billy also forces her family to acknowledge her truth. Let's watch. When I hear Uncle Haibin talk about carrying the burden for Nainai, I'm reminded of some of Jesus' final words to his disciples. Greater love has no one than this, Jesus said, that he lay down his life for his friends. Most of us aren't ever called to sacrifice ourselves so physically or dramatically as Jesus was. But we are called to lay aside our egos, including our sense of moral superiority, and shoulder the burden, Jesus called it the cross, of loving others. There was nothing right, nothing moral about Jesus' execution. And yet his death is one of our most cherished sacraments. Do we stand on the high ground and cross our arms and say we'll have nothing to do with something so wrong? Or do we kneel in the mud with Mary and with John and contemplate a love that transcends moral categories? We see that this is not Billy's first experience with secrets. She's been on the receiving end before when her parents deemed it too painful or too troubling to talk about the loss of her grandfather and of her childhood home. If there's a difference between the omissions at the beginning of Billy's life and the omissions at the end of Nainai's, it's this. Billy had to live with those losses. The unexplained and ungrieved absences sat inside her for years, a reality waiting to be acknowledged. The lie of Nainai's cancer is, regrettably, not a reality she will have to live with for long. I think what's most interesting about this scene is not that it provides us with some kind of calculus to decide whether a moral compromise is worth it or not. Rather, it reveals that no matter what we decide, however we choose to love the people around us, especially through our conflicts, we're bound to get it wrong. And when we do, it's even more essential that we cling to love as our guiding principle. Love for others as they hurt us. Love for ourselves as we are hurt. And even love for ourselves as we hurt others. This is that part in the message where I'm talking more to myself than to anybody else. It is so hard for me to forgive hurts, those of others and perhaps especially my own. I work so hard to be careful not to hurt people. I believe that if I put enough thought and prayer and time and sweat into navigating a conflict, that there should be a way to minimize the damage. I think most of my adult life has been a slow process of realizing that's not the case. For all the care I put into my coming out, it was still the most painful thing my family has ever experienced. And there's still a part of me that kicks myself that wants to go back and try to get it right this time. To use different words to say things I didn't say or not say things I did say. But I can't change any of it. It's also true that in the 14 years since I came out, there has been so much good that has flowed into my family. It doesn't cancel out that pain, but it does help restore the balance. Our marriage was a new beginning, a watershed moment that said we were going to try to leave the wounds of the past behind. And let me tell you, trying to keep up with Langston does not leave much time for perseverating on the past. Perhaps this too is part of what Jesus meant by laying down one's life. That our old selves, with all of the things we have perpetrated and suffered, must be allowed to die if we are to live in community. Again, that doesn't let the community off the hook. Love must guide our families, our churches, and even our divided country to stretch and accommodate those who challenge us. And we have to be honest in saying that love doesn't always mean we will walk hand in hand. Jesus didn't chase those who left without joining his cause. He loved them enough to let them go. And sometimes love for ourselves means putting up protective boundaries and speaking truth to those who hurt us. Today, we may not be able to reach each other across the divide. But if we leave that door open and refuse to demonize the other, who knows how life may change us all. In a few minutes, we're going to take communion, a meal that Jesus chose to share even with Judas, who he knew would betray him just hours later. Before that, let's take a few minutes to reflect on those relationships in our own lives that have suffered some kind of rupture. Perhaps the disconnection was sudden and unexplained, like Billy's loss of her grandfather. Perhaps the loss has been more gradual, eating away at the bond like the cancer in Nainai's lungs. Maybe it's a loss you suffered years ago. Perhaps it's just begun. Whatever the case, as we listen to this song from the end of the film, let's hold that door open in our hearts and echo the prayer. O troubledness concealing an undivided love, the heart beneath is teaching the broken heart above. O see the darkness yielding that tore the light apart. Come, healing of the reason. Come, healing of the heart.